Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also appointed to law and public affairs, and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Hi, everybody.
So if there's one thing we can agree on and count on politicians to do, I think spinning the news and spinning the presidency is one of them. Presidents in particular have developed elaborate systems and infrastructures to help shape the way that the public understands what's going on, understands what they are trying to do and what they've done, and to frame stories that come out of the media about them in particular ways. It's not simply become one part of presidential politics, but I think many people agree it is an essential part. And there's many stories about how presidents have had legendary innovations to do this. It's become an art form, and it's impossible to understand presidential history without understanding how this practice developed. So today, to speak to us about the history of spin, we have David Greenberg, who's a professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. He's a frequent commentator as well in the news media. He's written many books, including Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, and most recently, Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency, a book that's received a lot of attention about the rise of the White House spin machine since the progressive era. David's also a contributor, a regular contributor to Politico magazine, where he writes an outstanding column about all things historical as they relate to current politics. And he had served as a managing editor and acting editor at the New Republic before. So, David, welcome to Politics and Polls.
Thanks. Great to join you guys.
So maybe we should just start so we're all on the same page by asking you to talk to us and define what spin actually is and how you use the term in your book.
Yeah, I think that's important. You know, people use the term in a lot of ways. For some people, spin is, you know, putting the best face on something, a kind of public relations job. For others, spin has come to mean lying, even. I tend to think when we call something spin, we're sort of suggesting that it stops short of lying. Otherwise, we'd call it lying. For me, spin, as I define in the book, kind of in relation to the presidency, is really the effort by presidents and others to shape their images and their messages, and by extension, public opinion. And the Republic of Spin, as I describe it, it's really about the development of not just doing spin, which has always been part of politics, but a specific apparatus, a machinery of spin that becomes part of campaigning, becomes part of governing, becomes part of what it means to practice politics in the 20th and 21st centuries.
And who are the presidents when this started, meaning the institutionalization of spin, as opposed to what obviously presidents and politicians have always done?
Right, exactly. And that's the distinction to make. And so for that reason, I start my story in the progressive era, in particular with Theodore Roosevelt. I think political scientists seem to talk more than historians do about a modern presidency, starting with Theodore Roosevelt and then as well by his not direct successor, but near successor, Woodrow Wilson, that these were the presidents who really had a very different vision of what the presidency should be. You know, T.R. has his famous stewardship theory, or famous at least to political scientists, the idea that the president's role, the president's powers, were not confined to what was strictly delimited by the Constitution, but could include anything except that which was ruled out constitutionally. So he had a much more capacious view of presidential power, and he had a much bigger agenda and set of ambitions for what he wanted to do in terms of reform from the White House. Instead of deferring to Congress as sort of the leader in shaping reform legislation and so on. And so to do that, Teddy Roosevelt has to win over public opinion. This is going to be his lever for getting change through. And to win public opinion in this new age when you have mass circulation newspapers, you're beginning to see newsreels. Very soon you'll have radio. So in this new age of mass media, Teddy Roosevelt decides to go to the public through speaking tours, through publicity stunts, through reporters by holding the first proto-press conferences, and through a whole series of new practices, really begins to put in place this machinery that just about every president after him in some ways refined and developed in different fashion.
And this is the bully pulpit.
Right. This is the bully pulpit. I mean, the bully pulpit, we can say, is a piece of it. That's the rhetorical part. And Roosevelt, you know, unlike really most of his predecessors, goes on these long trips. He'll go out west. He'll go down south on these train trips. And he'll speak in, you know, dozens, even hundreds of towns. And each time his speeches are written up in the local papers. And he's doing this often to advocate for specific policies. In the 19th century, generally speaking, when presidents gave speeches, it wasn't policy advocacy, it was ceremonial. I mean, there were occasionally policy statements, but you didn't have the idea that if you wanted to pass your health care bill, if you wanted to pass, say in TR's case, railroad regulation, the idea was to take to the stump and to give speeches and, you know, generate support through speaking directly to the public. And that really was the idea of the bully pulpit. And then, of course, Woodrow Wilson, who is also a great orator in a very different way from Roosevelt, but quite talented in his own way, developed this practice too. So he goes on these wide-ranging speaking tours, but he also gives speeches to Congress that are policy speeches and tries to, he gets press attention for them, but he's also engaging directly to Congress. And that's also a tool that we still see presidents making use of today.
Now, all of this is in the pre-broadcast era. So to what extent, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, since in my lifetime, I learn about what presidents think by, in many cases, seeing them on television or hearing their voices. To what extent does their personal, did Teddy Roosevelt's actual in-person persona matter in getting these messages across? Same for the other presidents as well.
Well, it really does. Even though we don't have, you know, radio and television yet, there is film. You have the newsreels, you know, certainly by Wilson's administration. You have even things like recordings of TR's voice were made on wax cylinders that could be played. You know, so you could go to the movie theater and they would sometimes synchronize a recording with the newsreel. So you wouldn't quite have sound films, but they sort of tried to approximate that.
But Teddy Roosevelt did this before, I mean, the first newsreels in 1909. And so he had to have done this without that tool, right?
Right. So he doesn't have the newsreels, although there are some short campaign films. I mean, the very first campaign film I write about in the book is William Kinley in 1896, I think, if I'm remembering. And so it's sort of just, you know, the movie projector and so on has just been invented, and it's already being exploited for political purposes. Yes, and then TR comes in 1901. But people did have a sense of him. You know, his meetings with reporters sort of were legendary, so you start seeing kind of the personality of the president becomes a thing. You know, it becomes something that reporters are enchanted with, that they write about. By the election season of 1920, at least, maybe even a little earlier, you see stories in the newspaper, you know, the candidate with the best biography is going to win. It really becomes about the president as a persona and not just as a representative of the party and the party platform.
And this is all before polling.
This is all before polling.
Which is until the 30s.
Right. So, you know, one of the things I try to do in the book is to take readers along on a narrative of the development of all of these different pieces of today's very complicated spin machine. So I talk about when the speechwriters first come into the White House, and that's in the 1920s.
With Warren Harding, right? Isn't that what you write?
Yeah, with Harding. hires a guy named Judson Welliver, who doesn't yet have the title of speechwriter, but he's essentially writing speeches. And Welliver, like a lot of speechwriters over the years, began as a journalist. He had been one of the little posse of kind of favorite sons of Teddy Roosevelt, who would meet with TR in the White House periodically for little gab sessions where TR would try to spin them. And then he goes over to the other side working for the president. One thing that's amazing about Judson Welliver is that he continued, even while he was working as the White House clerk, literary clerk, he continued to write magazine profiles of Harding and Coolidge. I think he stays on for Coolidge. So there's really, no sense of a wall between his journalistic and his White House role, that those distinctions and, ethical rules really develop much later.
So surrogates are not new in some ways.
No, not at all. I mean, it's if anything, the way you see, there's much less compunction among journalists in the progressive era in the 20s about being kind of a spokesman or shill for the president or other politicians than there is today. I mean, today, the journalist goes into government, there's a lot of tut-tutting in the sense that he's kind of betraying his cause. But this is really quite common. And in fact, most of the great sort of presidential spin doctors, say in the first half of the century, came out of journalism. It's only later that being a professional political consultant becomes a viable job description unto itself, and people start coming into administrations that way.
So with the advent of this, how much time have presidents spent on this? I mean, you're painting this picture in which I imagine McKinley spending a lot of his time doing the job of being president, and then later presidents increasingly spending time on messaging and conveying a pose or a feeling that they'd like to convey. And I'm just trying to get a feel. At some point, when do you think this started taking off as a large fraction of the time that the president spent doing it?
Well, it's very hard to say what counts, because for someone like Theodore Roosevelt, and even I would say for Wilson, for one thing, they wrote their own speeches. So that's a form of spin.
It takes time.
Yeah, their own time. But they're also thinking about how to frame their messages, how to reach the public. A lot of the time, even when they're on so-called, substantive business. I think in some ways the, hard and fast distinction we like to fall into between spin and substance really doesn't hold up. The best spin is rooted in substance. It's a spin that's not just a kind of pack of lies or just, selling us, a lot of words, but is actually engaged with the business of, understanding the policies or the ideas that are being promoted. Now, it is the case that as the government gets bigger, and here you really, like with so many things, see Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal as the takeoff point, you start to get more committees and more interagency working groups. It's with FDR that there's formally a White House press office. It's then with Nixon that there's a White House communications office. And so as these offices grow, there's obviously more man hours being devoted to these questions of message and image. So in that sense, it certainly grows as an object of the president's attention.
Let me just walk back in time. It seems that war is always an important part when the nation goes to war for spinning or trying to shape the news. And you write about George Creel as an important figure, and historians often teach about World War I and the mobilization, understand some of the dynamics you're talking about. How important was Creel as a figure in your history, and how important was World War I to the history of spin?
Yeah, World War I really is a central moment here, and Creel's a key figure. He is yet another one who begins his career as a journalist. He's a progressive journalist, even something of a muckraker. And in fact, one of the muckraking exposés that he writes, I believe for Harper's Magazine, is funnily enough, about Ivy Lee, the public relations agent for Rockefeller, who is trying to sort of salvage the Ludlow massacre, which was when a number of miners were killed in a labor dispute out in Colorado. So here's George Creel attacking these, you know, the new PR men, specifically Ivy Lee. And then a few years later, he goes to work for Woodrow Wilson, first as a kind of a PR guy on the reelection campaign in 1916. And then when America goes to war in 1917, he heads up what's called, in very neutral terminology, the Committee on Public Information. And, you know, I think all of these practices of spin and all of these committees and so forth have to be understood as having a dual nature. We tend to be so negative about spin, and in some ways that's a product of World War I itself, that we forget that there is a legitimate informational purpose behind it. I say in the book, you know, spin is used for misleading, but it's also used for leading. And the idea behind the Committee on Public Information was that there should be a kind of central clearinghouse for government information to be given to the press and the public, that with World War I, the number of government agencies grew. There was lots of information about wartime production, as well as about military development that needed to be disseminated, and this would be a kind of central place for it. At the same time, it had another much more controversial purpose, which was in sustaining morale. And so you see the line being blurred between the provision of information, which is an aspect of spinning that we probably all can agree is legitimate, and the sort of drumming up of support, which can bleed into a very partisan or partial and sometimes misleading or deceptive, you know, presentation of news and information. And so Creel comes under fire for sort of hyping the war, and this is generally how historians have remembered him. But what I discovered in my research is this is kind of a revisionist portrait written and formed by, you know, journalists, advocates, historians who were, you know, in a bad temper after the war ended and who had soured on the war. During the war itself, George Creel was attacked much more from the right wing for being insufficiently jingoistic and for not putting enough hate into his materials, for not being anti-German enough, that they thought he played it too straight. He was too wedded to this idea of just straight up information without the emotional content. And so in a way, he got it from both directions. But the historical memory of him, I argue, has been a little bit unfair, that it casts him just as a kind of American Goebbels almost, as someone who's just fomenting hate. And, you know, there was a lot more to the picture than that.
To fast forward a little bit, just to the current time, how much of this storytelling, information, or leading or misleading, whatever you want to call it, how much it requires in the modern time an apparatus of people to help with that? Because one thing that's really notable about the current administration is that there's been actually a fairly tough time finding for President Trump to find people to populate his administration, either because they're slow out of the gate recruiting people, or, you know, maybe because they can't rely on normal political actors and normal agency heads and so on, just because they are renegades from the political process. So how much of this requires an organized shop of people, and does the current administration have such a shop?
Well, I think, you know, depending on the ambitions of the presidency, yeah, you need many hands. When Teddy Roosevelt, to go back to him, wanted to promote and sort of manage the publicity for the building of the Panama Canal, a project that was very dear to him, he put in charge of it a guy named Joseph Buckland Bishop, who was a New York journalist sympathetic to Roosevelt. And in fact, this generated all kinds of controversy on the Hill in Congress, because they thought the president is trying to use taxpayer dollars for this, you know, public relations man to promote his agenda, you know, perish the thought. So the more you want to do, the more you want to promote, you need a bigger team. And so you start seeing this with TR. By the New Deal, every agency has its own little department of communication specialists. You know, I think Trump's had trouble staffing his administration. It doesn't seem to me that in the press area is where they've been laggard. It seems like the State Department, you know, yeah, some of...
It's almost like, I mean, the press part, I guess now that I think about it, it's the part they have. And so in some sense, right, Trump is like a consumer of spin who's been put in the position of being in charge of government. And so as a consumer, he thinks that spin is all that the job entails. And in a recent interview, he said that he thought that the job would be somewhat easier. He thought that it was going to be less stressful than whatever he was doing as a real estate developer or an entertainment figure. And so at some level, he in some ways embodies the idea that spin is all there is. And at some level, we're doing a big natural experiment to find out whether, in fact, spin by itself is enough.
Yeah, although, you know, in fairness, he's not the first. I mean, I think Reagan, in some ways, you know, put the public messaging and the public presentation of his agenda, you know, at the center of what he did. And he really didn't sweat the details of policy at all. And there's all kinds of stories from the Reagan years of reporters, you know, saying in cold print, you know, the president really has no familiarity with what his own administration's policies are.
David Stockman's memoir, he writes about just the spectacle of presenting Reagan with a page memo with two options, and Reagan says, yeah, let's do both of them. And like, what? No, the ideas are going to do one of them. But the thing is, Reagan was surrounded by people who were movement conservatives who had an idea of exactly how to achieve what they wanted to do. And so it may be that he was not a very detail-y kind of guy, but he had people in place at multiple levels of government to implement the thing that he would maybe generally outline.
Yes. And I think, you know, Trump does, you know, I like your insight that he understands the job of the presidency as kind of what you would see on TV, you know, sort of the difference between Reagan, the actor, and Trump, the reality TV star. You know, that said, he's still, there's always decisions to be made. There's always, you know, conflict to be worked out. I mean, I think Trump, you know, from what we can gather from press reports, sees his job as kind of hovering above it all. All right, how's it coming with these negotiations on the health care bill? He's not exactly rolling up his sleeves and getting into it himself, but, you know, he's keeping tabs on what's moving along which tracks, or at least he's trying to.
But you look at these older presidents, these are, I'm not so sure about Harding, but a lot of these presidents had a pretty clear idea of exactly where they'd like to get to, right? It was true of Wilson, it was true of Teddy Roosevelt, certainly true of Franklin Roosevelt, Reagan. These are presidents who had a goal that they were driving towards, and spin was in the service of that.
Very much so, and it actually coexists with being in the service of self-promotion, which, you know, I think this is politics. There's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, you even see in the term publicity this kind of double meaning. Publicity begins to, you know, as defined as making things public, bringing this to the public, to public opinion, the way I was talking about with TR. But it very quickly also starts to mean sort of publicity in the service of self-promotion and love of the limelight and so on. And, you know, most politicians, you see those two things are conjoined, that there's ego and there's love of the spotlight, but it's also in the service. They go into politics or public service because they have certain things that they deeply care about. You know, is that there with Trump? You know, I tend to think he's mainly committed to power and glory and attention, and he loves that. You know, how deep his, you know, economic populism runs, paleoconservative strains of his thought, which I think are there, but how deep they are, how much he really cares about reforming trade policy or even immigration policy, where you think, well, there's some conviction there. Very hard to know at this point. And because he's populated his administration with people who have very different beliefs from each other, which I should say is also not that uncommon. I mean, when Obama did it, it was celebrated as team of rivals. And when Trump does it, it's palace intrigue and infighting. So there's a little bit of a double standard, perhaps, to some degree. But yeah, I mean, it's a matter of who's going to get his ear.
Well, let's turn from Trump to Nixon and see what we can learn. President Nixon is often thought, for many people who are not experts, is not thought of someone who's particularly good at spin, at television. You know, you have the bookends of the Kennedy-Nixon debates where famously he couldn't spin himself.
Right.
And it obviously ends with Watergate. But when you read your book, you see a different part of him, someone who is much more sophisticated, understanding the news, the nature of polling and television, all of which come together while he's both vice president in the 1950s and then president of the United States. How did he, also a complex figure and someone whose views are a little more difficult to categorize than Reagan, for example,
right,
what was his relationship to this history?
Yeah, well, you know, my first book, as you mentioned at the outset, was on Nixon's shadow. And in some ways, the germ of Republic of Spin was, you know, came out of writing that Nixon book. In one of my first chapters about Nixon in the 1950s, I looked at his famous Checker speech where he comes under fire for having kept the secret funds or slush fund as senator. And it almost forces him to drop off the Republican ticket as the vice presidential running mate to Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. And he goes on TV to what was then the largest audience that anyone had ever enjoyed in human history. You know, he has more people seeing him give this speech than have people have viewed any speech. And what's remarkable is that although the Checker speech is remembered today and even by his presidency as maudlin and hokey, he talks about this Cocker Spaniel that his daughters had been given as a gift. It was named Checkers. That's how it gets its name.
The cloth coat.
Right. His wife's Republican cloth coat. There had been Truman administration scandals of people receiving mink coats as gifts. So this was a kind of jab at the Truman scandals. My wife wears a good Republican cloth coat. So all these kind of mawkish touches. But most people at the time not only found it persuasive, but the words they used to describe Nixon were authentic, genuine, sincere, sort of all the opposite of the way the speech is remembered today. So he clearly was effective in those early days of television. And then, you know, he sort of struggles to stay on top of this fast-changing medium, because what happens is public perceptions and public sophistication changes. You know, when they first start doing these sort of man on the street campaign ads where people off on the street testify to the character of some candidate, it's seen as very credible. But in short order, people kind of catch on and know that these are hired actors and so on, and they fall from favor. So audiences get more sophisticated. And by 1960, you know, Nixon is outclassed on television by JFK. You know, that said, he continues to put publicity and spin really at the center of his understanding of politics. And he's quite open about this. In his memoirs, he has this great quote, many people have cited it, where he says, "In the modern presidency, concern with image must rank as high as concern with substance." Again, making that distinction that I think is somewhat artificial, but he's quite open about it. Now, at the same time, like a lot of politicians, he denies that he's concerned with image. So, you know, he goes on the Today Show to say, you know, "Oh, I don't look at the polls. I don't worry about my image. People who get caught up in that, you know, don't succeed." And that very morning, he's writing a memo saying, you know, "We need a White House media advisor who should tell me where I should sit and if I should hold the telephone with my left hand or my right hand," and all these minute details that he cares about in terms of shaping the public image. And so you see this kind of obsession with image in Nixon, you know, that sometimes works. I mean, look, he was elected in 1968 after people really considered his political career over. He wins by a landslide in 72. So, yeah, so the notion of him as unskilled with spin clearly doesn't hold up. My favorite Nixon anecdote is when he, at one point, you know, he always envied and admired the Kennedys, and he sees these shots of them sailing or walking on the beach and looking so relaxed and romantic. So he decides to do his own sea shot, as it's called, and he's at his, you know, Western home in San Clemente, California, and he summons all the reporters and photographers to this bluff by the ocean where they're going to get some good shots. Then he comes out for his walk, but he's wearing trousers and wingtips, you know, instead of looking like he's on the beach. And instead of looking Kennedy-esque, he looks like someone trying to seem Kennedy-esque. And I think with Nixon, that always came through to some degree. There was always that sense of he's trying to shape his image. And so his persona, his image was somebody who was working at it. And I think in a way he's kind of a metaphor for kind of the public awareness now of how much the presidency and politics has become this sort of contest of images, this contest of spin. And so he's a very pivotal figure. You know, he's also the first, he creates the White House Office of Communications. He, you know, has all these working groups designed to promote every policy agenda, whether it's, you know, his Vietnam plan or whether it's an economic plan. They draw up these lengthy game plans, who's going to contact which reporter and what the message is going to be. So there was a depth and obsessionality to it with Nixon that I think, you know, has sort of remained, maybe not quite to that intensity, but you really can't have a White House now that doesn't try to coordinate its messaging in that kind of elaborate way.
I want to link this back to what I would regard as something that has to do with the technology, or let's, you know, I'm a neuroscientist, so I can't help but do this, but the neuroscience of how we interact with these things. If we, some of these things you mentioned are expressly visual, and the three of us trade in ideas, we use texts, we use words, I analyze data. We're constantly doing stuff with numbers and words. And when I think about Nixon doing these things, there's one kind of thing he does, which is he goes out on the bluff and he's wearing his dorky shoes and he just looks like a big dork trying to be cool. But then there's all this other communication, which is in words. And it makes me think about the fact that spin, which you, we're discussing as per your book, as this continuous parade of evolving techniques and this thing that's been with us for over 100 years. But spin has now turned into something that is primarily done visually, maybe through short texts such as tweets, but we now do it through television, through cable. And I think it's possible for casual citizens, you know, everyone, you know, you can't be a casual citizen, you're a citizen or you're not, but citizens now consume information through visual media. And so now what they see becomes real for them, in the sense that if I think back to the Clinton administration, some of it was visual, but some of it was these documents that were the Clinton administration's welfare plan or whatever it might be. And I can't help but think that as we become more visual and less intellectual in the kind of information that we get, that spin has become this visceral thing that comes to us through our televisions. And if we take it to the extreme, current times, it gets back to what I was saying about the president. He gets all his information through television. He does it through tweets. He only gets the non-intellectual things. And that's the way most Americans get their information. How would people know that Hillary Clinton had, you know, whatever, hundreds of policy documents? How would we know that John Kasich had a whole bunch of stuff, right? You see what I'm getting at? Like, and spin has become this immediate, unmediated channel of information from politicians to their constituents.
Right. Well, I mean, look, the age in the book, I kind of periodize the history of spin since Roosevelt with different names. So I begin with the age of publicity, and then the 1920s, where you see the arts of promotion and PR really take over American culture and advertising. That's the age of ballyhoo. And it's really, you're already at the age of image making by, say, the 60s.
But now we're talking about actual images.
Right.
Like photos, images. Like, okay, go on.
Yeah, so television images, you know, 1963 is the year that more people get their news from television than from newspapers. That, I think, is the year of the shift. That's also the year that the nightly news broadcasts go from 15 to 30 minutes. So sort of in that Kennedy era, they're really, it's sort of television comes to dominate. And, you know, in the book I write about the Reagan years, as many other people have noted, as one in which Michael Deaver, his public relations aide, and others really go to great lengths to make sure not only that they have a line of the day, like a message they want to put out, but an image of the day. Reagan with school children, Reagan at a factory, Reagan, you know, standing on Pointe du Hoc, you know, for Normandy, and that these images they hope will lead the nightly news. So there's this very conscious effort to prioritize image even by then. I think now, as the internet comes to displace television, at least to some degree, in a way you have words are back in the mix. I mean, I think we kind of have a melange of word and image now that are sort of shaping politics.
Sure,
and
but that, short reads rather than long reads, like not a big document or a book, but like a tweet or a paragraph at most.
Right. Well, that's fair enough. But it's also, you know, images are less ideological than words. And in a way, I think there is a sharpening that sort of in our polarized times, there's a sort of sharpening of partisan spin and ideological spin over a more kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of, you know, banal image making of the president as a man of strength or a man of compassion. There's sort of less of that as the goal and more, you know, spin taking the form of partisan warfare.
Let me ask, you wrote this book. I know you were writing it for a while and it comes out in January 2016.
Yeah.
And then the presidential election a few months later throws things in American politics in a different direction. And here you have a book that's about image and spin, and all of a sudden the conversation changed closer to the election once President Trump became President Trump. Do you think kind of the way the book is received and read is different as a result of that election, or does the election not really change what you were trying to say, or more importantly, how people are reading the book?
It's interesting. It's a good question, and I'm not sure entirely. It was an interesting phenomenon going on book tour and giving talks about the book throughout 2016, and I would talk about Theodore Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Calvin Coolidge, and then I get all these questions about Trump, who's not even in the book. But it did sort of force me to think about Trump in relation to a lot of these issues. And then with the surprise election results, I came to wonder, as I actually did while writing it too, well, gee, do I have too much faith in the capacity of the American public to distill, you know, lies from truth and, you know, see through spin?
I'll go with yes on that one.
Right. I mean, part of the book is, it's not quite a defensive spin, but it's like two cheers for spin. It's making the argument that, you know, spin is the language of modern politics and we shouldn't condemn it. We have to learn to live with it and understand it. But in a weird way, I found much more than with my other books, or really the Nixon book, the paperback has really gotten a lot more attention and interest. The paperback came out like just as Trump was being inaugurated, and it kind of got this new life. And I think because Trump is such a media figure, both in his tweeting and his consumption of cable news, but then also in, you know, his own attitudes toward the press, and even in, as a creation of the media, there's so many ways in which that intersects with who Trump is and the story of his success that, you know, the book has become useful, perhaps, in trying to understand Trump, even though he's not in the book itself. So it continues to provide me with sort of ideas and a framework for thinking about Trump. I just wrote a piece for your colleague Paul Starr in the American Prospect magazine about Trump's war on the media and, you know, trying to understand this in some historical dimensions that, you know, clearly grows out of having written this book.
Phil, can I ask you one last question? There was an article in the New Republic about historians and how historians feel in the era of President Trump. There's been many stories over the months involving statements about history, whether it's been about Andrew Jackson or Frederick Douglass. There's been just his statements in general that often have few facts to support them. You're a historian who's very active in the public sphere. You write a lot of articles in magazines and newspapers. Do you feel differently about how you have to do your work and how you have to write and speak after this presidential election? And this is related to my question about your book. Or do you feel it hasn't really fundamentally affected the way you do your business?
I actually don't feel terribly different. In fact, I've sort of been surprised that I haven't felt more of an impulse to sort of join the, you know, historians against Trump brigade, the notion of somehow standing up as a historian against Trump. Because, I mean, you know, my own political views of the guy, you know, could not be more contemptuous. But as a historian, I guess I sort of, I tend to like to resist against the herd. And even though I think there's plenty, I mean, take his recent, you know, pretty ignorant remarks about Andrew Jackson in the Civil War as an example. There were so many people who kind of rose up to attack him for this with a kind of degree of outrage that, to me, kind of in the overall scheme of things to be outraged by, you know, this was fairly low on the list. That, you know, anyone with a kind of high school education about the Civil War could kind of understand why these were dopey remarks. And I don't think at this point anybody had any illusions about Trump being, you know, terribly knowledgeable about 19th century politics. So I kind of think, you know, as historians, yeah, I'm constantly engaged with present issues and they stimulate the questions I ask and the kinds of things I want to write about. And I'll often write pieces that aren't even about history. But that when it comes to getting into the past, you know, I really don't find a, you know, partisan or even a liberal or conservative framework to be the most helpful. It feels actually kind of boring or predictable to look at history in those terms.
Well, that wraps up our episode. And I want to thank David Greenberg again, who's, again, a professor of history and journalism and media studies at Rutgers and the author of a fantastic new book, Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency. Came out with Norton 2016, available everywhere in paperback, too. And I think people will really enjoy it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you both. A lot of fun.
And thanks to everyone out there. We'll be back again soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.